Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We begin our program today here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Looking at the Freddie Gray trial, we were going to talk about the Freddie Gray trial in terms of its beginning today. The voir dire, jury selection was supposed to begin at 9:30 this morning. But the Court of Special Appeals has postponed this trial, delayed it. We're joined here by A. Dwight Pettit, a defense attorney who's represented clients in lawsuits against police in many, many cases. And Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. And you at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Don't jump on our Facebook pages, but do call if you want, 410-319-8888. First, let me start with you, Doug, and I want to talk to Dwight about the extraordinary measures this judge has taken and what this might mean. But first, talk about this, what this whole issue is about from the very beginning.
Well, first of all, we have to begin from the idea that it's exceedingly rare for an appeals court to intervene during a trial, a criminal trial. It simply doesn't happen except in the most extraordinary circumstances. So the defense has filed a motion challenging Judge Williams' ruling that gave immunity to Officer Porter to testify against Officer Goodson. Officer Porter doesn't want to testify against Officer Goodson because he's a fellow police officer, because there is this unofficial code of silence, and because Officer Porter is asserting a privilege against self-incrimination. The prosecution then gives Officer Porter immunity, meaning that the prosecution cannot use Officer Porter's testimony against Officer Goodson in Porter's retrial. So that protects Officer Porter's privilege against self-incrimination because the government can compel any of us to testify if we're a witness to a crime, as long as we are protected against prosecution ourselves for something that we say during the testimony.
But there was something unprecedented about this, you thought, when we talked earlier, Dwight, about what the judge ordering Porter to testify, and also you had some thoughts about why it was probably a good idea for the Court of Appeals to postpone it.
Well, it's an
Special appeals.
Special appeals, thank you.
It's an unprecedented situation because even though the state has given immunity, use immunity, to Officer Porter, there's still two other things flying around up top of this case, and that's the potential federal investigation. Unless they have a letter from the Department of Justice immunizing him, he still has that exposure, number one. Number two, there's still the possibility of a perjury charge based on his conflicting testimony in relationship to the information he gave the investigators versus what he stated in the first trial. And you got to remember also, this is a situation where if the state is going to use him, but the state has basically indicated in the first trial that he was perjuring himself. And so there's still exposure, and I think that's where we get into the novel area here, that here you got one of the first situations where a person is not only a witness, although he has been immunized, but he is a potential, not a potential, he is a defendant. In the subsequent trial, which is scheduled for June. And he has potential jeopardy in relationship to federal prosecutions and perjury prosecutions.
It sounds like this is really kind of complicating.
I don't see it complicated at all, Mark. And I think lawyers can make it sound more complicated than it really is. And I think certainly the defense lawyers for Officer Porter are making their argument, as they should, before an appeals court. But what's not complicated about this is that any time the government has the right to offer immunity to obtain evidence that allows the truth to be told in a courtroom. Officer Porter's a witness to an alleged crime. And so by offering him immunity against whatever he says, that doesn't mean that Officer Porter could not be subject to a perjury charge if he takes the witness stand and testifies untruthfully. Every witness is subject to perjury once you take the oath. Nothing unusual about that. And the federal prosecution, There are Supreme Court rulings that hold very clearly that any time a witness is compelled to testify on a grant of immunity, that testimony cannot be used in a federal case. So there's a lot of argument here, a lot of smoke that's coming across that makes it appear that Officer Porter is subject to something that would endanger him. But indeed, what we should be looking at is the public has a right to hear from Officer Porter. They have a right to know what happened when Officer Goodson stopped the van. And I think that's where we have to turn our attention. The prosecution, in my opinion, is doing what prosecutors should be doing.
And I'd like to agree with Doug wholeheartedly, because I am a big advocate that police should have to, in fact, testify and tell us what happened. But putting on my hat as a defense lawyer, mm-hmm. I do see problems in terms of potential jeopardy, which I am not sure that our high courts in this state, as well as he indicated, the Supreme Court has dealt with in this delicate nature. Now, the second part of your question, Mark, is I don't see how they could proceed this morning without the case being postponed, because how are lawyers going to open? I mean, today was going to be the seating of a jury, but out of that, you're talking about after that, you're talking about opening arguments and what have you. I don't think it would be fair to the defense or the prosecution to have to opening arguments and start your trial without having a strategy of knowing whether or not, as the government said or the state said, quote unquote, whether their material witness is available to them or not.
So that's what I'm saying. This is what complicates it all. I mean, it's not that cut and dry, it seems to me. And looking at this Court of Special Appeals, this is a very different body than it was when Judge Bell ran it. So I'm curious what you all think from the tenor of what you've heard in the court so far, whether or not they're going to uphold the judge's decision to force Porter, compel him to testify, or whether they will go along with Porter's defense team and saying no.
So first, this is the intermediate appellate
court.
This is the Court of Special Appeals.
Okay.
This is not the Court of Appeals that Judge Bell sat on.
Right.
And the intermediate,
it's the court below that.
Really, what's clear about this to me is that Maryland law allows the prosecution to do exactly what it's done. It said that Officer Porter's testimony is necessary in order to prosecute Officer Goodson. They've made that showing. They've also said that they are not going to use Officer Porter's testimony at his own trial, which is now scheduled in June. For the intermediate court to even take this argument is extraordinary. I doubt that this would be happening in the trial of the ordinary indigent defendant who usually faces charges. But because you have a police defendant with able counsel, this case is now going to get a decision. And I would be extremely surprised if the Court of Special Appeals did not affirm Judge Williams.
Let me take one exception with Doug.
Okay.
Because when Doug talked about the perjury issue, like he said, anybody can be charged with perjury because everybody's expected to tell the truth when you take the stand. That's why you take the oath. I think what Doug, and I would like to hear him address this, what he's omitting is that we have had a trial where there was a hung jury, and the state inferred in the first trial that Porter was in fact lying. And that is the red herring here, as I see it, because that's something that they can come back, not what he says in this trial, but they can come back from the first trial and he'd be subject to criminal prosecution.
Officer Porter will be questioned about matters involving himself and Officer Goodson. The testimony that came out in the first trial had much to do with what Officer Porter allegedly did or did not do himself in terms of not seatbelting, of not bringing Freddie Gray to a hospital. I don't see those issues arising in this trial, because what we're looking for Officer Porter, what the prosecution's looking for, is for Officer Porter to tell the jury what conversation did he have with Officer Goodson when he first approached the van.
So I have questions here. Let me open the phones here. We have some people calling in and joining here, Doug Colbert and A. Dwight Pettit, two of our leading attorneys, Doug Colbert, of course, professor of law, Dwight Penham, one of our leading defense attorneys, has taken on the police department many times. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Neil, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Mark. This is Neil Janey again. And
oh, Neil, how are you?
Good morning, Neil.
Good morning to Professor Colbert.
How are you, Neil?
Taught my son so well, and to my former colleague, Dwight Pettit. I just want to raise something that came up actually on a couple of shows. Maybe Professor Colbert is not aware of this. I understand the point that he's making about enforcement of the state's grant of immunity in the event that there's a federal prosecution, but there's the possibility of the feds looking into obstruction of justice and conspiracy to obstruct justice. And that's because of the other version of the incident involving Freddie Gray. That is, if you accept that, irrespective of what the state medical examiner concluded, that Freddie Gray was either beaten or injured by the officers who arrested him based on what you see on the video, then what the feds may be looking into is whether or not Proctor and these other officers collaborated with each other for Proctor to change or to walk back, rather, the statement he made to the IA investigators that when he opened the door, in addition to Freddie Gray saying that he needed medical assistance, he also said he couldn't breathe. And if the feds take that as the possibility that, you know, there was an intention from the very beginning when Officer Proctor saw Gray in distress to obstruct justice, then the immunity may not apply to that. I mean, the immunity only applies to you know, the narrow case that's been articulated before, but there's another possible thread here.
Okay.
And so that's bound to be litigated, I think, when, you know, they take up this issue about the scope of this immunity. And I'll just hang up and listen.
Oh, you can hang on if you want to, Neil, because you're adding this interesting former prosecutor with us as well here. But why don't you respond to Doug, and then I'll let Dwight jump in. I have a question for Dwight.
The immunity that's been granted only applies to the second trial against Officer Goodson. The feds would be absolutely within their power to look at any testimony that took place in the first trial when Officer Porter testified, and if they wanted to consider obstruction of justice charges or perjury charges, I suppose they could look into that. It's very rare that the feds, federal prosecutors, hardly ever intervene in state matters. So it would take an unusual situation again, but we're only talking about immunity for what Officer Porter would be saying in the trial against Officer Goodson.
That's my point, too.
So what does it mean? So this is still, I mean, when the Sun writes, Williams said, talking about Judge Barry Williams, who has ordered that Officer William Porter should be compelled to testify, which is what's holding up the trial now, until the Court of Special Appeals decides whether or not that will stand. Williams said he found himself in uncharted territory as he granted a type of immunity that allows Porter charges to stand, but which precludes his testimony from being used against him. But what does that mean, uncharted territory?
What he's saying, my interpretation of that, this is the first instance where you're talking about immunity for a person not only the state considers to be a material witness, but a person who was a defendant and getting ready to be a defendant again in his second trial since the first trial hung. And I think that's the unique situation that it makes this different from most grants of immunity. Where it's an investigatory witness that you granted to receive additional information on your general prosecution.
So let me ask you about this question. Each one could answer differently. Supposing the court does not uphold the judge, what happens then? Supposing the court says he does not have to testify, what happens then?
Well, my opinion is that state is very, very strapped then to be able to prove his case, because they would have to do it either by some type of circumstantial evidence or some exception to the hearsay rule to get in the statements that Porter made to the original investigators, and I don't know how they would do that. I think if he was ruled that he did not have to testify, it would be a death knell to the case, in my opinion.
I think that when you're dealing with a police defendant courts look at issues much differently than they do when it's your ordinary defendant. So if an appellate court would tell a trial court that they couldn't use evidence to prosecute a case, that would be almost a landmark decision. Usually with the appeals court...
This is different because they're compelling somebody to testify.
Yes, and that is the power that the prosecution has. So what the appellate court would be doing would be something that appellate courts hardly ever do, which is to tell the trial court that, no, you do not have the discretion to make this decision. And what you're doing in part is you're telling the prosecution you can't prosecute someone because someone else is asserting a privilege that's already protected from immunity.
If it's so cut and dry, why is the Court of Special Appeals taking so long making its decision?
They're not taking so long, Mark. Let's be fair here. They got the defense papers of the motion on Thursday morning. Their order simply said we must allow the state to respond. The state responded Friday afternoon. That's pretty quick to respond to a 35-page motion. And now they're saying, let's make a decision. And so it's not like they've had this case. They're moving expeditiously, and I assume that the Court of Special Appeals will make a ruling soon.
And let me know and throw another fly in the ointment.
Go ahead.
If the court were to say that Judge Williams' order stands and Porter has to testify, then what you keep referring to, Mark, would be the avenue of going to the Court of Appeals, asking the Court of Appeals to consider a writ of certiorari on this whole matter. And so that also could be a valid reason for postponement because the highest court in the state would not have spoken. And there might be some argument, if the Court of Appeals affirmed the same thing, that you might have a direct avenue, and the professor can correct me, direct avenue to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Again, the usual course of things is for appeals court not to interfere with the trial process. If someone's found guilty, they have a right of appeal. What's happening now, and I think it's happening because we're looking at a police defendant. All of a sudden, everyone's very concerned with defendants' rights. I only wish that were true for the average person who's accused of a crime.
And on that part, I agree with you totally.
And so we shouldn't lose sight here.
No, but there are two things here. One is that, which is we've been talking about a great deal in this program, which is how different this is than an ordinary, everyday citizen defendant and what they go through and how long they have to spend in jail before they can get to their trial and how long it takes for them to get to trial in the first place, and whether or not they get bail and all that is very different in these trials. But I think the other part of this, I'm going to go to the phones here, was Dwight was saying this could be delayed even longer if the defense appeals, which they will probably do.
And that appeal can be heard and dismissed the same day as the Court of Special Appeals rules. You don't want to prolong the trial because
that's what the defense attorney does.
Well, the defense would love to
delay it. In this case, I'm hoping Doug is right.
And they've already and they're taking the measures they need, Mark, in order to protect the appeals record.
410-319-8888. Leroy, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Leroy. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm listening to this show, and I guess the former prosecutor that you actually had on there kind of hit somewhere near what my question was. The coroner said that the young man was murdered. The video that they showed had three other officers outside of Goodman and Porter, Officers Goodman and Porter. Apologies. Now, as a regular layperson, if two people were arrested for, say, an attempted murder and someone... the person later died, wouldn't everybody that was involved on the, the criminal part would be charged with murder? We don't even, I mean, even if this doesn't go as far as it's supposed to go, if the two officers was acquitted or hung jury again, the actual officers who was on the video, wouldn't they wouldn't even be prosecuted is what I'm asking, I guess.
That's a good question.
Well, and that's where the grand jury would have heard evidence against each of the officers to determine whether there was probable cause, reasonable cause, to believe that an officer committed a crime. And the grand jury returned charges against each of the six officers, but there are different charges against each. I believe four of the six officers are charged with one type of homicide, and two of the officers are only charged with assault.
But I think the major issue that's becoming here is the public is watching the video, and they see Freddie Gray injured before he's put into the van.
Right.
The problem with that, of course, is that the state's attorney at the time, Ms. Mosby, had to, in fact, follow what the medical examiners gave her, in my opinion. And the medical examiners concluded that it was a homicide, but that the homicide occurred in the van. And so she was sort of locked in. You got to remember the city was burning at the time. She's waiting for the police report. She's waiting for the autopsy. She gets the autopsy and bang, she follows the autopsy. The other three officers who were in the race look highly culpable to have done something wrong.
Right.
But the autopsy doesn't shift the weight to them.
That's really interesting. That I think that's one thing that's really confusing the public a great deal. Again, a lot of public looks at breaking down racial lines because the officers we're talking about in the original arrest were all white, and the prosecutors seemed.
And that might be why you had a mistrial in the first trial, because you've got to remember there was conflicting medical testimony in the first trial, both by the defense as well as the prosecution.
And we don't know how that jury broke
and
down.
And the
jury,
the argument is, don't believe your lying eyes. You saw the condition he was before he's in the van, yet the medical autopsy doesn't address that.
410-319-8888. Cynthia, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Cynthia.
I'm calling. I like to comment to the professor, and I like to thank you for being honest and explaining, breaking down all the steps, including what they're trying to do in this case, because some of the public don't understand certain things because they're going so fast and moving, and that's what it's all about, confusion. So you're breaking it down as they go along, and I like to thank you.
Well, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
I've really been trying as best that I can to provide that type of information. Most of the people who have been commenting on the trial have really taken a very strong pro-defendant, pro-police perspective in their comments. And I spent every day in December watching every minute of this trial from the point of view of wanting, as best I can, to explain complicated legal information. And that's our process. Our process is to allow a jury to make a decision. But we have to keep in mind, Cynthia, and I'm sure you know this, that 98% of police killings, there are never charges brought. This is one of the rare prosecutions that we're actually able to see and hear what took place.
I have a question. I wish we had more time here today, but let me try to get Tyrone on, and then I'll come right back to Dwight with a question. 410-319-8888. Tyrone, welcome.
Yes, and let me first what I'm about to say by saying I have nothing against what Ms. Mosley has done. She has done an excellent job trying to get these things to trial, and it is a first. You know, usually the police officers get off, so this is not a hit against her. Let's not get it confused. And as far as I'm concerned, as was stated more than once, it's clear to see from the video, and people say, don't believe your lying eyes, that the young man was injured before he was placed in the police van. And I think those charges, yes, the officers that drove the van, et cetera, should have been charged, but I think the officers that arrested him actually gave the injuries that led to his death. And we saw that they were flipping the bird. They actually gave you the FQ sign to the people in the audience, so to speak, as if to say, we're going to get away with this anyway, so... You know, what y'all say or think does not matter. They actually flipped the bird to the people that are watching. If you look at that video, as they were taking Freddie Gray away. So they definitely showed a depraved heart mentality when they arrested him. And it's taken nothing from Ms. Mosley. I understand that you got to go by the medical examiner, but you got to remember, we were told first that he tried to injure himself. Then we were told that he heard himself with a screw in the van. And then, you know, now we're saying, now they're saying, now believers. We know what we're talking about now. Okay, so that's what the public's looking at. We're being told not to believe our lying eyes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Tyrone. Dwight?
Well, the only thing, he's correct. I'm saying I think that's a great deal of the confusion, what people saw versus what the medical evidence came out in the first trial in terms of that's why I believe it was a hung jury. But I think one of the Doug was saying, I think the uniqueness of this case, the national uniqueness of it, and why FOPs and national organizations are concerned, Mark, is not just the fact that we're prosecuting a police officer or police officers for the fact of what they did, which is rare in itself, but here you're also prosecuting them for nonfeasance, what they should have done, their negligence, and that takes on a real significant role. And remember, initially, it was even more significant than that because Ms. Mosby indicted on the basis of false imprisonment and false arrest, which got into the areas of probable cause and articulable suspicion, which she later dismissed. So you've got some things in this case which speak not only to the state of Maryland, but speak nationally to police misconduct.
No, and that's absolutely true, because what we're looking at is police reckless conduct. They're aware that Freddie Gray was injured. They're aware that he needed medical attention, and they consciously disregarded it. That's the state's theory.
Well, I want to thank the two of you. I really do, A, appreciate the two of you taking your time out of your busy schedule all the time to come on this program to explain all this to our listeners. And as the trial unfolds, we'll get the two of you back here and keep on this commentary. I really deeply appreciate it. Dwight Pettit.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Great to have you. A friend for many, many years. Thanks for being on the show again, once again. And thanks for what you do. Defending Families Need to Be Defended. Good to have you here.
And thank you. You know, I also have a book out, Under Color of Law, which goes into a lot of the police brutality issues in Baltimore, Maryland.
Let's do that within the month. Let's talk about that book within the month.
Right.
Let's do that.
Sounds good.
Hey, we will do that. And Doug Holbert, I also want to appreciate the work you've done in justice and bail work in our society and keeping on top of this for us and breaking this down. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure, Mark.
We'll see you all. I guess a lot over the next several months.
Exactly.
Thank you both so much. We're going to take a very brief break, and we're coming right back to look at Governor Hogan and Mayor Stephen Rawlings Blake saying that they are going to tear down houses in Baltimore. What does that mean? We're going to get into that with our guests. On the way to break, we are hearing Lazarus by David Bowie. David Bowie, of course, who passed away from cancer yesterday. Stay with us. We'll be right back.